This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We have a room, 28 minutes, the top experts, and a big issue to try and understand. This week, Northern Ireland. Is it, as a former Chancellor suggested, heading for the UK exit anytime soon? ...2021 marks 100 years since the creation of Northern Ireland. The year has also begun with a recent Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, predicting that Brexit has now put the North on a trajectory out of the United Kingdom. There is a mechanism that would allow this, a border poll, and one recent opinion poll suggests a small majority now in favour of holding one. So this week, I want to know just how Northern Ireland could exit the Union and whether it's at all likely. Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we need a bit of history, provided by Margaret O'Callaghan of Queen's University Belfast.
Ireland is partitioned by the Government of Ireland Act 1920. You can see it as a British attempt to look after what they would call their own people in Ireland, the Unionists of Ulster. Numerically, its concentration is in Ulster. So how are the borders of Northern Ireland determined? Really by what the leaders of Ulster Unionism tell the Tory cabinet they most desire. They could have had a nine-county Ulster, but that would have been 50-50 nationalist and unionist. They could have had a six-county Ulster, which is what they in fact finally opted for. The alternative was that they'd go for a four-county Ulster, where they'd have a clear numerical majority, but a smaller territory. So what the Ulster Unionists want was what the Ulster Unionists got, the largest possible territorial area where they had about a two-thirds majority and a very substantial and alienated nationalist minority. The intention of Home Rule had been to give Ireland an extremely limited form of self-government within the United Kingdom. By 1937, the new state is almost fully independent. It's certainly independent enough to pursue a policy of neutrality during the Second World War. And then after the Republic of Ireland is declared in 1948, formally signifying that Ireland is now fully independent. The Second World War changes things. The welfare state in Northern Ireland results in an educated new cohort of young nationalist Catholics emerging politically in the late 50s and the 60s. And the inequalities, the gerrymandering, 50 years of like one-party unionist government becomes unacceptable to this new generation. And out of that, you get the civil rights movement that comes to prominence in the late 60s. And out of that, you get a re-emergence of the Irish Republican Army. By 1972, the British government, especially after the killings of Bloody Sunday, realised that internationally they are being profoundly embarrassed by what's going on in Northern Ireland. And that's really why they suspend Stormont and take power from that devolved administration for the first time since 1921. So the point about Northern Ireland is its legitimacy was never accepted by Northern nationalists because their language on it always was. It was set up and its borders were drawn on the basis of a sectarian headcount. It's not until the Good Friday Agreement that Irish nationalism revises its position and says that may always have been our position, but we now accept that reality is what it is in the present, and we have no choice but to accept that a majority in Northern Ireland will be required for any constitutional change. And that's a huge shift in Irish nationalism. It was accepted that Northern Ireland is a divided society, that while it remained jurisdictionally British, people within Northern Ireland were entitled to consider themselves British or Irish, as they always had done. It recognised the entitlement of Northern nationalists to aspire to a united Ireland, as opposed to just painting them as disloyal enemies of the state. The context of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 was the context of the European Union. Large sums of European peace money supported it. The language used to sell it spoke about borders within Europe, the lack of hardness of borders, the new dispensation that Europe allowed. So the whole language of the Good Friday Agreement was that Northern Ireland and Ireland lived within this larger context of the European Union, as of course did the United Kingdom, and that a future of flexibility was present and offered in that European context.
Margaret O'Callaghan. Next, we need to understand the mechanics of a reunification referendum. Alan Rennick is the chair of a unit at University College London with a very specific title, the Working Group on Unification Referendums on the Island of Ireland. Alan Rennick, what does the Good Friday Agreement say about holding a referendum on the future status of Northern Ireland?
The agreement sets out a broad framework for such a referendum, but then doesn't fill in terribly much of the detail. So it's very clear that unification of Ireland could take place only if there had been a referendum vote in its favour in Northern Ireland. Essentially, it is clear that there would need to be a referendum in the Republic of Ireland for unification as well. And then the agreement says that the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, so the person in the UK government responsible for Northern Ireland, is responsible for the decision on whether there will be a referendum in Northern Ireland. And the Secretary of State can call a referendum pretty much at any time. And she or he must call a referendum if it appears likely that there would be a majority vote in favour of unification.
Wow. I have to confess that some of that comes as something of a surprise to me, and I should have been paying more attention. And I imagine it will come as a surprise to listeners as well. So the Secretary of State has the full right just to say, I think actually we're going to need a referendum in Northern Ireland. Now, presumably, there are criteria that you would expect the Secretary of State to use to make that determination.
The Good Friday Agreement doesn't say what criteria the Secretary of State would use. There are a number of kinds of evidence that the Secretary of State might use. Election results in terms of votes cast and seats won, might look at evidence from opinion polls and surveys. And if there were a vote held within the Northern Ireland Assembly saying that Assembly members felt that the conditions had been met that required a referendum, then that also would likely weigh heavily in the mind of the Secretary of State. What's fundamental is that both in law and simply for reasons of the security and stability of Northern Ireland, the Secretary of State must act with impartiality, cannot appear to be trying to push the result in one or other direction through their decision on whether to call a poll or not.
Are you saying that if, say, the Northern Ireland Assembly said there should be a border poll, and opinion polls were suggesting it, that if the Secretary of State said, no, but I just don't want a border poll, he or she could be subject to legal challenge.
Yes, absolutely. The courts could intervene and say the Secretary of State must call a poll.
Well, let's talk about the Republic element of it. You say it's generally understood that if there were to be a border poll in Northern Ireland, the South would have to hold its own referendum. Would you then have to have two separate deliberations go the same way for it to give effect to a vote for reunification?
Yes. So if either the North or the South voted against unification, then unification would not take place. And therefore, you know, although the decision to call a referendum is a decision in the first instance for the Secretary of State in the UK government, clearly the Irish government is deeply involved in this process right from the start as well. And one would presume that the UK government would want to be in close contact with the Irish government. And it would be important indeed for the two governments to be cooperating all the way through this process in order to ensure that it was conducted fairly and seen to be conducted fairly so far as possible on all sides.
Now, I imagine from what you're saying that the holding of a border poll does not tell you anything about the conditions which would then pertain if the border poll were to go in favour of unification.
Well, that very much depends on how you choose to run the poll. And basically, there are three ways in which you could run this referendum. One approach would be that you simply put the principle of unification to voters. So you would ask people whether they want a united Ireland, and there would not be a plan already worked out for what would then happen if people did vote for a united Ireland. A second approach is one in which you do have a plan for how you would work out the shape of a united Ireland after a vote in favour of unification. And then a third approach is one in which you actually have that plan worked out before the referendum. So in that third approach, essentially the Irish government would have worked out in close collaboration, presumably with as many other voices as possible, what constitutional changes it wanted to make in order to form a united Ireland. It would work out various other key policy matters to do with healthcare provision, policing provision, and many other issues. And it would set that out in as much detail as possible in advance of the vote.
It's hard for me to see how that sits with what you said about the Secretary of State not showing partiality, because it seems to me that you'd have to actually put a package that you had constructed as part of the border poll. And you're not going to then turn around and say, well, that's a lousy package.
Well, the Secretary of State has to show impartiality in deciding whether to call a vote. It seems pretty likely that if a referendum takes place, the Irish government is, in a sense, constitutionally obliged to support unification. That's a constitutional principle in the Republic of Ireland. A UK government, it seems rather likely, would be supporting a continuation of the Union. So once the referendum has been called, then it seems likely that the governments would favour one or other outcome. But the crucial thing is that both governments are not intervening in such a way as prevents the people of Northern Ireland and the people of the Republic of Ireland from making a free, fair, unfettered choice about what future they want for Ireland.
Okay, but in my mind, you're now painting a scenario in which the Republic of Ireland government would be saying, yeah, go for it, and the government of the United Kingdom would be saying, don't.
It seems likely that at the very least, the politicians in those two governments would be arguing those points. And you can see the possibility of a great deal of contentiousness in this process. And that is one reason that we in our working group come strongly to the view that it would be a very bad idea to go into a referendum such as this without a plan. That is, if you like, the Brexit model for how to run this referendum. And whether you're a supporter of Brexit or an opponent of Brexit, I think it's difficult to argue that the process that we went through for those 4.5 years after the Brexit referendum was a process that we would want to repeat, especially in the, you know, deeply sensitive context of politics in Northern Ireland.
Alan Rennick, opening my eyes at any rate to a process about which I had no idea. What I did know was that the majority in Northern Ireland has historically been unionist. So how are unionists feeling and thinking about things now in the wake of Brexit? Joining me in the briefing room is Sam McBride of The Newsletter, a unionist paper based in Belfast. Sam McBride, how far has what's happened with Brexit changed the world of unionists?
It's really transformed the future of the union in Northern Ireland, the stability of the union. I think it's important to look at this in the context of where we were 5 years ago before the referendum. At that point, the union was more secure than it had been at any point in the history of Northern Ireland, almost 100 years at that point. All of the polling was pretty consistent in this. All of the anecdotal evidence was consistent. There was no great campaign for Irish unity. And I think there was an element of hubris on the part of some unionist leaders. They thought that would be the case forever. And events transformed that. Suddenly Brexit, then the collapse of Stormont not long after, really saw support for the union hemorrhaging away. And there has been really no coherent plan by unionism to stop that happening. So unionism is still thrashing around, trying to explain why most unionists backed Brexit, but Brexit has self-evidently undermined the union, while really not having a clear vision of how they get beyond this argument at this point.
How has Brexit affected the way in which unionists feel about Westminster?
Unionists have always had a very significant distrust of the British government. They have never believed that the British government would protect their interests when it really came to the crunch. And that's one of the reasons why historically many unionists have supported devolution in Belfast. They viewed that in 1921 in some cases, and certainly today, as something of a bulwark against what they would see as perfidious Albion. So there's an element of agreement between Irish nationalists and unionists on not trusting the British government. But that has really been re-emphasised, I think, to a spectacular degree by what has happened over the last couple of years. We've had a situation where even when unionists have had more power over a British government than they have ever had in the history of Northern Ireland, and probably frankly will ever have at any point in the existence of Northern Ireland, they have been unable to prevent what they see, I think, with very significant justification as a massive betrayal of them, a constitutional betrayal by a prime minister who came to the DUP conference. I was there. I heard him say it. It was a year before he became prime minister, but he was categoric. He said no British government, no British prime minister could ever support the sort of Irish Sea border, which he then imposed. And so therefore, that has led some unionists to not just question their support for the Tories at that point, which of course became immaterial after the election. I spoke to a founding member of the DUP, somebody who was there with Ian Paisley when the party was founded in the 1970s. And he said in the heat of the moment, in the emotion after that big betrayal by Boris Johnson, he said, I am now questioning whether I support the union because of the nature of how we've been treated here.
Does conventional unionism, as a result of all this, or as a result of other trends, have the same popular hold that it did until a few years ago?
No, there's a massive problem for the established unionist parties in Northern Ireland, mainly the DUP, the Ulster Unionist Party, which built Northern Ireland, has since really fallen away very significantly. Neither of those parties are able to really convey a message which grips particularly younger voters. There has been a very significant change over recent years. In 2017, in the Assembly elections, unionism lost its majority in Stormont for the first time in the history of Northern Ireland. That was a very significant moment, and it wasn't because people were necessarily going to the Irish Nationalist or Irish Republican parties. They were in many cases going to parties in the centre, the Alliance Party, the Green Party, People Before Profit, which is a socialist party. And so there is a sense that unionism is losing touch. That doesn't mean that in a border poll, those people don't vote for the union. But in terms of voting for unionist parties, it's increasingly seen as something that really doesn't speak to where modern Northern Ireland is today in 2021.
It's quite clear from your point of view, we are not there yet. So let's talk about whether or not you think we might be progressing in that direction. And that requires you a little bit to consult your crystal ball.
I think we clearly are progressing in that direction. 5 years ago, we were not even talking about this seriously in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin would, of course, make a pretty perfunctory call for a border poll, but there was no real belief in it. We're in a situation now where there are multiple campaign groups springing up calling for Irish unity. Many of them may be, in some cases, close to Sinn Féin, but at a certain distance. And there is a real energy to that. So I think that there are some Irish nationalists who view this as an really an historical historic inevitability. Irish unity will come. We just have to wait for it. I think that is profoundly mistaken. We've even seen in the last year how the pandemic, how events that nobody envisioned have transformed how people are going to view the union, how they're going to view Irish unity. Some of that in terms of the financial support from the British government might push people towards the union. The NHS might push people towards the union. Some of it in terms of how the British government has been seen to pretty disastrously handle the pandemic might push people away from the union. So there is really all to play for here, I think. And at this point, nobody really believes that a border poll is going to be won right now, but it's much dicier for unionism than they would like it to be and than it was, say, 5 years ago.
How dangerous would it be to go into voting on a border poll without being specific about what it actually entailed?
It would be profoundly problematic. It would be deeply dangerous and destabilising. I think that everyone across the UK and across Ireland as well has seen during the Brexit fallout really how emotive, how divisive these big constitutional changes can be. And that's even in a society like the United Kingdom, which is incredibly stable historically. That is not the case in Northern Ireland. We've come out of a period of decades of bloody violence, of people being prepared to kill, set off car bombs in the middle of city centres because they thought that would either bring forward Irish unity or would try to stop Irish unity. As bad as Brexit has been in terms of how it has really split asunder wider society in many cases across the UK, there was no suggestion of people taking up guns. There was no suggestion of people setting off bombs in the centre of London or Manchester. That would be a very serious suggestion for some people in Northern Ireland. And so therefore, this is not something to be entered into lightly. But at some point, it is also the case that if there is seen to be a majority for Irish unity, the government is not progressing towards a referendum, that is equally dangerous in this context.
Sam McBride. As we heard earlier, the only constitutional provision for holding a border poll is if the Secretary of State in London thinks there's enough evidence that a majority in Northern Ireland supports unification. But clearly, what Dublin thinks matters. So what does Dublin think? Joining me now in the briefing room is Etain Tanham of Trinity College Dublin. Etain Tanham, does the Republic of Ireland want the North to be incorporated into it?
That's a tricky question because when opinion polls have been performed over the past two or three decades, support for unification has always been over 70%. But in practice, really the Irish state developed very separately from the foundation of the state from 1921 onwards. So there's been a lot of, you know, isolation until the conflict in Northern Ireland from Northern Ireland. And the majority, vast majority of the population were very happy with the Good Friday Agreement as a solution to the conflict in Northern Ireland. So there was no burning desire for unification. But on the other hand, you know, it is in our constitution, although amended under the Good Friday Agreement. And that's important to state, too, that the territorial claim to Northern Ireland was amended by referendum to support the Good Friday Agreement. In the 2020 election, an exit poll did an examination of people's views, and 57% said they would like a referendum within 5 years. But when it comes down to the crunch, it's very unclear just how strong support would be.
Do people in the Republic have significant organisational and economic worries about what would happen if there were a full unification?
I think the first thing to state is that there's been very little research or planning or sort of brass tacks discussion of the issue at all. But there's a big question mark over whether there would be a long-term cost or whether there would be a long-term benefit. My perception is there would be concerns economically if we dug down into the very, you know, nitty-gritty issues of finances.
Now, has Brexit made any significant difference to both attitudes and to calculations in the Republic about a possible unification?
In terms of opinion, Brexit immediately put unification on the agenda because once the majority of the population in Northern Ireland voted to remain in the EU, it was a very obvious issue, even for those who weren't particularly nationalistic. For example, for the people who have a sort of neither identity, young people in Northern Ireland who are not as ideological about the constitutional status, it immediately put the issue on the agenda and therefore for public opinion and for the public in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland as well, because it was an immediate question that if there was a united Ireland, then Northern Ireland would be part of the EU.
Well, exactly. So crudely, does it make any significant difference that Northern Ireland is now economically closer to Ireland and the EU and less close to Britain as a result of what's happened?
Of course, at one level, it does, because business people, road haulage will move towards Ireland to ports where there's more unfettered trade, where, you know, they can trade more freely and not have the same blockages going from Ireland, say, through to France. So at that pragmatic level, yes. Obviously, also, Northern Ireland is now subject to the EU trade regime while also being in the UK. How significant it is once things settle down, that's a different question. But there are so many other issues in the mix, such as Scottish independence, such as the very drive for unification because of Brexit, that no doubt is occurring in Northern Ireland and is no doubt being discussed in Ireland informally and in the media. So there's so many factors in the mix. The so-called sea border, I think, is another issue which is thrown into that mix. In itself may not be a factor, but when you add it to all the other things, it very possibly is.
There is one party, of course, that operates both in Northern Ireland and in the Republic, which is Sinn Féin. And I imagine that they don't flinch in their desire for a border poll. Do you think their argument is gaining traction?
Sinn Féin has said different things at different times, and Sinn Féin itself is aware of the potential instability in having a united Ireland with a sort of Brexit result of a very narrow margin in favour and a large number of unionists extremely unhappy. So any party would be aware of that, and Sinn Féin is aware of that. It has referred to the need for reconciliation. But on the other hand, at various times, for example, after the Sunday Times opinion poll, and before that, it has called for an imminent referendum within 5 years. So it's strategic, and my feeling is they would not wish to have unification with division, instability or violence, for example. But at the same time, their brief, their key aim is unification, and they are calling for unification for referendum on it within 5 years.
So to be clear, is it their belief that by simply talking about it, you make it more likely that it will happen because it wasn't discussed previously, is now discussed? And secondly, that, of course, the more they're successful in getting it talked about, the more the Irish government, and to a certain extent the British government, must begin to think of a plan if a border poll were to happen?
Yeah, I think that's very much the case, that the more it is spoken about as something inevitable or that must happen, that is democratic, that would be the phrase used as well, the more likely it will happen. And the second aspect to note is that Sinn Féin was very successful among young voters in the February election. So I would estimate that support for unification among that cohort, say the 18-year-old to 25-year-old cohort, would be significantly stronger than among older age groups, because that cohort doesn't remember the conflict either. So they're quite different in their perception. And Sinn Féin's been very successful at keeping the issue alive there, using social media very assertively.
Etain, I'm going to be very unfair and ask you for a prediction. Do you think there is any significant chance of a border poll happening in the next 5 to 10 years?
In the next 5 years, no. In 10 years, maybe. You know, it's a very long-term process. I've mentioned the financial cost for Ireland. There are public policy issues around education, around health that would need planning, around so many issues where we are very different and have developed very differently in Ireland, as well as societal issues about perceptions of unionism and Britishness. So not 5 years, possibly 10 years and possibly longer.
Etain Tannam. So what do we take from all that? Well, it seems to me that even those who advocate a border poll are likely to be very careful about when and under what conditions it happens, which means not to expect it for some time. Famous last words. My thanks to Margaret O'Callaghan, Alan Rennick, Sam McBride and Etain Tannam. We're back at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The programme was mixed by James Beard and edited by Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might just enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. There's our recent episode on what the attack on the Capitol in Washington might mean for American democracy. There's our programme about how COVID-19 has brought the NHS close to collapse. And there's the one that asks why Vladimir Putin is so afraid of Alexei Navalny.
a new podcast series from BBC Radio 4.
In the first stage of a poltergeist haunting, the entity will confine itself to making noise, as if it's testing its victims.
The Battersea Poltergeist.
My name's Shirley Hitchens. I'm 15 years old. I live with my mum, dad, brother, gran, and Donald.
Subscribe to The Battersea Poltergeist on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.